from Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. The Gaza death toll stood at 2,016 Monday as the five-day ceasefire was set to expire. Gaza's health ministry said that the current total of wounded was at 10,196. There was little sign of any workable consensus emerging from ongoing talks between Israeli and Palestinian negotiators in Cairo, according to reports. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has said Israel would only accept an agreement which contained a clear answer to its security needs. For its part, Hamas has insisted that there will be no deal without an end to Israel's 8-year blockade of Gaza. The ceasefire entered its final hours Monday. Jocelyn Sambira reports from the United Nations.
Israeli and Palestinian delegations holding talks in Cairo are being urged to agree on a durable ceasefire before the current truce expires at midnight. The UN Special Envoy for the Middle East, Mr. Robert Suri, made the appeal on Monday before the Security Council. On August 13, a temporary ceasefire that was in place between Israel and Gaza was extended for an additional 5 days. On the fifth and last day of the truce, Mr. Suri called on the delegations to live up to this responsibility.
By the deadline later today, midnight Cairo time, or 5 p.m. here in New York, we urge the parties to reach an understanding on a durable ceasefire, which also addresses the underlying issues afflicting Gaza, or makes substantive progress towards it. At the very least, we hope that the ceasefire will be extended and the situation remains quiet.
The UN envoy also urged the council to make reconstruction a priority and to allow construction material like cement, bar, and aggregate into Gaza. Their access to Gaza, he added, must be facilitated in such a way that fulfills Israel's legitimate security concerns. Otherwise, Mr. Suri warned, the restrictions on the Strip regarding the exit and entry of persons and goods will continue to fuel instability. Jocelyn Sambira, United Nations.
We will bring you that presentation by the Secretary General's personal representative, Robert Suri, to the Security Council Monday in its entirety later in this newscast. Meanwhile, Israel's Shin Bet Security Service claimed Monday that it thwarted a Hamas coup attempt in the West Bank aimed at toppling Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas. The agency offered few details and no evidence to support its claim. Shin Bet said the plot was orchestrated by senior Hamas official Salah Aruri, who is based in Turkey and enjoys the support of local officials there. According to wire reports, Hamas had no immediate comment to the claim. There was no progress in ceasefire talks over Ukraine either, according to Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, speaking in Berlin after the latest session. We have this report from Press TV.
Russia says no progress has been made during crisis talks in Berlin on establishing a ceasefire or starting peace negotiations over Ukraine. The Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov made that remark after wrapping up talks with his counterparts from Ukraine, Germany, and France. Lavrov added that there were no positive results to start a political process in Ukraine. The German Foreign Minister Frank-Walter Steinmeier has also noted that a political solution in Ukraine is still very far off. The meeting in Berlin was arranged on Friday with tensions simmering between Moscow and Kiev over Russia's decision to try and deliver humanitarian supplies to eastern Ukraine. But Ukrainian authorities say they fear the aid convoy may be used to smuggle arms to pro-Russian fighters. Going to speak about that a bit further with Marina Kortunova, who is Press TV's correspondent from Moscow. Marina, do we know why these talks failed at this time? What more has Sergei Lavrov said?
Well, let me announce the Russian position on the issue. It is known that the negotiations will continue next week. I mean, the last one, the meeting, Berlin meeting, last Sunday meeting. So emphasizing that the ministers will use any possibility to ease the humanitarian situation in Ukraine and avoid further victims. Russian Foreign Minister Lavrov gave a reminder that Ukraine has violated all points of the joint Geneva Statement on Ukraine signed on April 17. The statement is aimed at three objectives with all three tasks sufficiently urgent. The first, an immediate cessation of the use of force. Second, an immediate solution of humanitarian problems. And the third, the immediate commencement of constitutional reform in a format that involves all regions of Ukraine, which is open and accountable to public opinion. Lavrov mentioned that none of these three requirements, which were signed by the Ukrainian side, have been fulfilled. Russia reaffirmed its position on ceasefire stop and has repeatedly declared it. This should be unconditional. According to Lavrov, Ukrainian colleagues unfortunately continue to put forward a variety of conditions and rather blurred, including, as they say, the impermeability of borders. The German foreign minister stated that he supports the sending of Russian humanitarian aid to the region. Sergei Lavrov said that Russia has nothing against the fact that the border crossing control was the most effective, and everything what depends on us we do means Russia. Also, the war in Ukraine has a direct threat not only to the civilian population of the Donetsk and Lugansk regions, but for Europe also. And following the footsteps of American policy, Europe is gradually drawn into the conflict in Ukraine. Yevro Union sanctions on Russia, adopted under pressure from the United States, had a response which primarily affects the European economy. Mercenaries from European countries are fighting against Southeast Ukraine, and mostly they are from Sweden and UK. Accusing Russia on unwillingness to promote Ukrainian settlement, Yevro Union leaders have forgotten about the current role of the Kyiv authorities for the war against its own people. So, shortly summarizing what have been told last Sunday and the situation with humanitarian control, here in Russia, we say that a road map is needed to achieve a strong ceasefire as well as the development of the basic principles of the effective border control. But the latest information by now.
And Marina, also tell us if you can, will these talks in Berlin continue at this time or elsewhere?
Well, actually, there is no information by the moment. I was only told when I called to the Minister of Foreign Affairs today in the morning, I told that the negotiations will continue this week or next week. Unfortunately, I don't know the place. So it's under I don't know, really. Nobody knows where they will be sent.
And more than a month after Malaysian airline flight MH17 was shot down over eastern Ukraine, Russia is demanding an official report on the progress of the investigation into that crash. Russia's UN envoy Vitaly Churkin said Monday that Russia wants, quote, a briefing by the UN Secretariat on the progress of the implementation of Security Council Resolution 2166, closed quote. Churkin said it's been a month since the start of the probe and pointed out that paragraph 13 of the resolution envisions periodical reports by the Secretary General on the progress of that investigation. On August 14th, the Dutch Safety Board, which is in charge of victim identification and probing the cause of the crash, said it had finished its work in Ukraine and that an internal report on the crash will be released during the first week of September. A total of 298 people, including 193 Dutch civilians and 27 Australians, died on July 17th as the plane crashed en route from Amsterdam to Kuala Lumpur. The crash took place over the Donetsk region of Ukraine. The investigation into the circumstances of the crash was seriously obstructed by continuing attacks by the Ukrainian military on the area held by separatists. Ukrainian authorities claim the plane was shot down by independent supporters. The latter say they do not have the necessary equipment to hit a target flying in the upper regions where commercial air traffic operates. WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange may be leaving the Ecuadorian embassy where he's been holed up for the past 2 years. We have this report from RT.
After spending more than 2 years trapped in a tiny embassy room, WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange has made a sudden announcement.
He said that he can confirm that I am leaving the embassy soon.
What Julian Assange left out, though, was how exactly he's planning to do that, though there were somewhat cryptic hints. RT's Polly Boyko was at the news conference for us.
Well, we probably haven't had this big a crowd outside London's Ecuadorian embassy since Julian Assange first sought refuge here over 2 years ago. But the press is here because of reports that he's suffering from ill health and that he could be emerging from the embassy today to give himself up to British authorities. Now, there's certainly no shortage of police waiting for him to grab him in case he should make an appearance. He would be extradited to Sweden, where he's wanted for questioning, and he's always said that he fears that he'd then be sent on to the US, where he's been investigated for over 4 years now for publishing US diplomatic cables back in 2010. Now, I was just in a very small press conference with Julian Assange and Ricardo Patiño, Ecuador's foreign minister, inside the embassy, and in response to the question that's gripping all the press outside as to whether he's leaving today, well, he said very cryptically that he is planning on leaving very soon, but not for the reasons that the press is reporting. I asked him about his health as well, and reports that he's got a chronic lung condition and a dangerous heart condition. And he didn't reply specifically about the conditions, but he said that he is suffering as a result of spending 2 years inside the embassy. It has no garden, so he's not able to go outside to catch any sunlight or get any fresh air. And he said that in the 4 years that he's been in confinement here in Britain since he was first arrested, when he was in prison, in solitary confinement, he did get an hour a day outside. He doesn't get that now. But throughout the press conference, Ricardo Patiño was talking about needing to get to a diplomatic and legal breakthrough with the British authorities to either secure safe passage for Julian Assange to go to Ecuador or to overturn that extradition request. Now, at the end of the press conference, I can say that I saw Ecuadorian Foreign Minister Ricardo Patiño leave the embassy, and I saw Julian Assange go back to his quarters inside the embassy. But for now, we're outside and we're waiting in case he should make an appearance. Reporting from London, I'm Polly Boyko.
On Monday, the personal representative of the Secretary General, Robert Seri, made a report to the Security Council about the situation in Gaza. We now bring you that presentation in its entirety.
We meet today against the backdrop of a restive region with heightened political tensions and a severe security threat by the Islamic State in Iraq and the Levant and al-Nusra Front, as well as the recent attacks by violent extremist groups from Syria against Lebanese armed forces and internal security forces in the Lebanese town of Arsal. Given that the Security Council has already been seized of those very worrisome situations with its adoption on 15 August of Resolution 2170 on countering the threat of ISIL and the ANF, and with its press statement of 4 August on Lebanon, I would like to focus my briefing today on the situation in Israel and Palestine, with an emphasis on Gaza. As we meet, the temporary ceasefire between Israel and Gaza is holding, now on the fifth and last day of its current extension, with Israel, Israeli and Palestinian delegations in Cairo meeting separately with Egyptian authorities in a crucial effort to break the deadlock of violence and retaliation. I recently traveled to Cairo in support of these important talks, and the Secretary General has continued to engage with the parties and stakeholders to end the violence and reach a durable ceasefire. The hopes of the people in Gaza for a better future and the hopes of the people in Israel for sustainable security rest on those talks, and we call on the delegations to live up to this responsibility. By the deadline later today, midnight Cairo time, or 5 p.m. here in New York, we urge the parties to reach an understanding on a durable ceasefire, which also addresses the underlying issues afflicting Gaza, or makes substantive progress towards it. At the very least, we hope that the ceasefire will be extended and the situation remains quiet. I think we all share the relief that no blood is being shed at the moment, but we also all regret that it has taken too much time and too many lives to achieve this pause. The toll of this third major escalation in Gaza in 6 years is appalling. A total of almost 2,000 Palestinians have been killed, of whom 459 are children and 239 are women. This total includes more than two-thirds civilians. Some 10,000 Palestinians, roughly a third of them, again children, have been injured. 64 IDF soldiers, 2 Israeli civilians, and 1 foreign national have reportedly been killed. A few dozen Israelis have been directly injured by rockets or shrapnel. In the face of this devastation and loss of life, the United Nations has mobilized its every effort, including through the personal engagement of the Secretary General, and working closely with regional and international stakeholders to end the violence. We did not relent despite setbacks because the loss of civilian life was so unbearable. On 2 occasions, we were successful. On 17 July and on 26 July, humanitarian pauses allowed civilians a much-needed respite from the violence. The temporary ceasefire that currently prevails has granted civilians another such reprieve for the past 8 days, and I would like to commend the government of Egypt for brokering it. It is essential that the guns remain silent to allow civilians to resume the necessities of their daily lives and to allow for increased humanitarian early recovery efforts, addressing the manifold needs of the people in Gaza, such as urgent repairs of water and electricity networks, and finding more viable shelter for those displaced who are not able to return to their destroyed homes. Mr. President, it remains my conviction that we must not leave Gaza in the condition it was in before this latest escalation. Otherwise, the restrictions on the Strip, on exit and entry of goods and people, will continue to fuel instability, underdevelopment, and conflict. And I'm afraid the next escalation will be just a matter of time. As I told the General Assembly recently from Cairo, the basic equation must consist of ending the blockade on Gaza and addressing Israel's legitimate security concerns. This has become even more urgent given the unprecedented amount of destruction wrought on the Strip during this latest escalation and the corresponding unprecedented level of humanitarian needs. The assessment of Gaza's reconstruction needs has not yet been completed, but there are indications that the volume of reconstruction will be about 3 times that needed after the so-called Operation Cast Lead in 2009. Approximately 16,800 housing units have been destroyed or severely damaged, affecting some 100,000 Palestinians. Reconstruction is the main priority, while exports and transfers are crucial to help Gaza's economy get back on its feet. Construction materials must be allowed into Gaza to this effect, aggregate, bar, and cement. And their access to Gaza must be facilitated in such a way that fulfills Israel's security concerns. The United Nations stands ready to lend its support in this regard. For years, the UN has been importing construction materials for UN projects under a mechanism agreed with the government of Israel that comprises robust measures to monitor the exclusively civilian use of all materials entering under that mechanism. This system has demonstrably worked, prevented diversion of materials, allowed successful implementation of crucial projects, and built trust. Reconstruction of the magnitude which is now needed can only be addressed with the involvement at scale of the Palestinian Authority and the private sector in Gaza, meaning larger quantities of materials are required to enter Gaza. We stand ready to explore with the relevant stakeholders how the UN's proven mechanism can be expanded to monitor a PA-led, private sector-driven reconstruction program in Gaza. Mr. President, the engagement of the donor community will also be indispensable to help Gaza back on its feet. We support today's announcement by Norway and Egypt to co-host the donors conference once a durable ceasefire is in place and once adequate access conditions have been established. I am heartened that the government of national consensus is resolved to spearhead the reconstruction agenda for Gaza as part of assuming its rightful responsibilities as the legitimate government of Palestine, in cooperation with the United Nations and other international partners. Last week, I met with Deputy Prime Minister Ziad Abu Amr in Gaza. I appreciate that he was able to enter Gaza via the Eretz crossing. After seeing with my own eyes the massive destruction in which whole residential neighborhoods have been flattened, I discussed with the Deputy Prime Minister and his cabinet ministers the way forward. Mr. Abu Amr assured me that the government of national consensus is committed to addressing the urgent and daunting challenges of governance, reconstruction, and security as part of bringing Gaza back under one legitimate Palestinian government that adheres to the PLO commitments. I reiterate the appeal that I made last week in Gaza. I call on all in Gaza to rally behind the government of national consensus and empower it to take charge and effect the positive transformative change that Gaza so badly needs. Right now, Gaza urgently needs houses, hospitals, and schools, not rockets, tunnels and conflict. We expect Hamas and all other factions to act responsibly in this regard and refrain from any actions that run counter to this agenda. Mr. President, we have been extremely troubled during this escalation by breaches of the inviolability of UN premises. On three occasions, there was a direct hit on UNRWA schools that were being used at the time with full knowledge of the parties to the hostilities as shelters for Gazans who had fled their homes to seek safety from the fighting. A total of 38 people were killed in those three incidents and 317 were injured. 11 UNRWA colleagues were killed in the line of duty. They, as many others, have been paying the ultimate price for their heroic effort trying to protect the most vulnerable and alleviate suffering, for which we honor their memory. An estimated 108 UNRWA installations have been damaged, and on 29 July, the Gaza branch of my own office, UNSCO in Gaza, was hit by a number of projectiles, which caused damage to the main building and to United Nations vehicles. On three occasions, rockets were found in UNRWA schools vacant at the time. These incidents are intolerable, and they are examples of the parties' disrespect for the vital provisions of international law that safeguard UN installations and staff, and that protect civilians. The Secretary General has called for a thorough investigation into these incidents to ensure full accountability. It is not yet clear, Mr. President, what kind of ceasefire understanding will emerge from these talks, and whether it will be reached by the fast-approaching deadline. That said, in any case, we believe that a sustainable solution must address the issue of governance, reconstruction, and security, all in the context of the return of one legitimate Palestinian authority to Gaza, which will undertake institutional restructuring, including of the security sector, and which should also gradually assume the effective and exclusive control of the use of force through the deployment of Palestinian security forces to border crossings and throughout Gaza. None of this will be easy, but we see no other way to change the dynamics in Gaza. As needed, and in cooperation with other partners, such as the European Union, the United Nations will support the government of national consensus in these tasks, taking advantage of our presence on the ground. We are ready to take on this role, provided that we are resourced and mandated accordingly. We also underline the importance of an international monitoring arrangement in support of ceasefire understandings. Given the implications for peace and security in the region, I trust that the Council will consider taking whatever action is needed in support of a durable ceasefire at the appropriate time. The flare-up in Gaza has also been accompanied by increased tensions and violence in the West Bank. Since 23 July, demonstrations against the Israeli military operation in Gaza took place across the West Bank, including East Jerusalem, almost on a daily basis, especially around checkpoints and refugee camps, often resulting in clashes with Israeli security forces. The most significant took place on 24 July, during the holiest night of Ramadan, when approximately 4,000 to 5,000 Palestinians, including some Palestinian Authority officials, marched onto Qalandia checkpoint. In East Jerusalem, demonstrations and clashes have spread as well. A total of 17 Palestinians were killed, including two children, and some 1,400 injured during this reporting period. Israeli security forces conducted almost 300 search and arrest operations, arresting 623 Palestinians. 17 Israeli security forces personnel were also injured. Settler attacks resulted in one Palestinian killed and 19 others injured. 12 settlers were injured by Palestinians. And on August 4, on a street near the Green Line in Jerusalem, an excavator, driven by a Palestinian, ran over and killed an Israeli pedestrian, and then turned over a bus, injuring five Israelis. The Palestinian was shot dead by Israeli police on the scene. On the same day, an unknown motorcyclist shot and injured an IDF soldier in the Mount Scopus area in Jerusalem. Mr. President, last but not least, we must not lose sight of the bigger picture. The increasingly restive situation in the West Bank and East Jerusalem, together with the Gaza crisis, should be a bleak warning to all concerned what the future will bring if we do not reverse the current negative trend towards a one-state reality, which is now on the party's doorstep. The slide towards a state of permanent conflict and hopelessness must be halted at once. The conflict and the occupation that begin in 1967 must be ended. The two-state solution is the only viable scenario in this regard, and we must urgently call on all on and support both parties to return to meaningful negotiations towards a final status agreement in which Israel and Palestine live side by side in peace and security. Thank you.
Missouri Governor Jay Nixon called out the National Guard Monday after another night of police battling with demonstrators in the city of Ferguson. We have this report from Press TV's Covey Tavwe.
At least one protester has been killed in clashes between police and demonstrators in the riot-hit city of Ferguson. The Missouri governor has ordered the National Guard soldiers to join the riot police amid escalating racial tensions.
Ferguson and Michael Brown Jr. will be a defining moment on how this country deals with policing and the rights of its citizen to redress how police behave in this country.
Police attack protesters in the U.S. city of Ferguson in an attempt to contain violent protests following the killing of an unarmed black teen by a white police officer. Armored cars have been deployed in the streets of Ferguson, making the city look like a war zone. Police have fired tear gas to scatter the angry crowd. Sunday midnight protests came in defiance of a strict curfew imposed by Missouri state officials. The protesters say it's their right to demonstrate peacefully. They say they'll continue rallies until justice is achieved. Racial tensions have been on the rise since 18-year-old Michael Brown was fatally shot by a Ferguson police officer more than a week ago. An autopsy report has revealed that Michael Brown was shot at least six times from very close range. According to the report, he was shot twice in the head and four times in the right arm. His bereaved parents want justice.
They want to know that they will have their day in court, that the killer of their child will be held accountable to the full extent of the law.
Meanwhile, rights activists have strongly condemned the U.S. officials' response to the deadly incident.
And see a young man, 18 years old, shot down in the streets unarmed. And rather than you address it, you tried to smear the young man rather than uphold the principles of justice and dignity.
Some others slammed the government's hypocrisy in propagating democracy around the globe while turning a blind eye to the rights of its own citizens.
Because we go all over the world promoting democracy and fairness, at least that's what we say. And yet we're not even creating democracy in our own communities.
America's minorities, African Americans in particular, are weary of decades of racial profiling and discrimination.
We have had enough.
Answer Coalition's Eugene Perrier is in Ferguson. He spoke with Liberation Radio's Ernesto Aguilar about the situation there Sunday.
It doesn't really matter to a large degree what your social circumstances are. Just the fact of being black in America opens you up to the potential for extrajudicial killing. And I think that if you look, you know, at St. Louis and at Ferguson, but really at our country, it's not that surprising why people are angry. And I said this in a short piece I wrote on liberationnews.org. You know, this is anger and frustration at the fact that there is just an unbelievable amount of discrimination and oppression, whether it's poverty in general, whether it's unemployment, whether it's harassment and brutality by the police, all of these things that continue on a day-to-day basis. And very specifically to Ferguson, unbelievable political disenfranchisement in 2014 to have a city that's mostly black, that politically is still completely dominated by whites, that has a police department that is patrolling these poor black communities, that is essentially completely white. And ultimately, it's not that surprising that when an issue like this happens, people rise up in anger because they are angry and frustrated, not just with the conditions, but the fact that from the public policy sphere, there's really only two responses that you get, which is somewhere between a continuum of, well, you know, we'd like to do more, but there's no money, to, well, it's their own fault for being poor and they should stop complaining. So I think those, all those factors added up together really allowed the tragic death of Michael Brown to become a catalyst, a spark for a lot of simmering tensions that exist, not just in Ferguson, but really in every major metropolitan area of this country with a significant population of Black Americans.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.